This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 118. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Rob?
I'm doing good, Mike, aside from the fact that I don't like anti-piracy code and DRM. Yesterday morning, I wake up and I have an email from our virtual assistant, Andy, who is trying to log into the academy, micropreneur.com. He's doing a little admin work, and the wishlist plugin that manages our membership just keeps telling him, you need to validate your product code. You need to click this button and validate the product code. Well, we've had this thing installed for 4 years, right? And although we've moved servers a few times, I mean, we've never had to go through this step again. And it turns out that if you try to log in, it wouldn't let us do anything in the wishlist admin. And then if you logged in as a user to the academy, it was deathly slow. It was like 20-second page load times. And so I email WP Engine. I'm trying to run YSlow. I eventually email wishlist. And as it turns out, they have a piece of anti-piracy stuff in their plugin that calls back to their server. And if it can't validate it by hitting their server, then it slows your site down. And their server was down. They told me the next morning that it had been hacked, but that's neither here nor there. It was, you know, I tried to hit their server and couldn't hit it. And so I figured that that was the issue. And sure enough, when they came back up, everything worked again. But it was just, it was like slap to the forehead, you know, like who does that? I mean, honestly, I've heard of maybe one or two other vendors doing this. And to me, it's such a single point of failure, such a way to piss off thousands of your customers.
I understand the mentality, but it's, I don't want to say it's the amateur mentality, but it's the mentality of people who feel like they're probably not necessarily offering enough value, or they're too scared of pirates to understand that the people who are building real businesses are actually going to buy licenses for it.
Right. And actually, you're one of the first people who I had heard say that. This is like maybe 2005, 2006. You had a couple blog posts on it, and we'll link those up in the show notes. But you basically said, because I was always of the mindset, you know, like in the shareware world, the micro ISV world, people would always have the license code. And you know, in order to use it, you needed the specific license thing. And you basically came out and said, I don't think that's the right way to go. And I think that hurts your customers, your paying customers, more than it stops the people who are trying to pirate your software. And that was when we were at a decision point with .NET Invoice, and we were looking at doing some type of registration code anti-piracy thing, and we decided not to after reading your posts and doing a little more research. But every time I run into this now, and it when I'm the customer and it causes me a great deal of pain and or a lot of angry emails from users, I totally think back to that argument of if you're really a small vendor, the anti-piracy stuff is typically not worth it.
That's totally correct. I mean, even the other way to look at it is how much time are you and effort are you going to spend as the vendor supporting those people who are legitimate customers who really did buy your product, and all you're doing is you're pissing them off and you're making their lives miserable. And then on top of that, because they're talking to you for support help because your anti-piracy mechanisms aren't working, or there's something, you know, going on that's making things slow, or your server got hacked, it doesn't really matter what the issue is. Every minute you're spending time working with those customers is a minute that they're pissed off at you and a minute that you're not getting work done. So you're basically killing time on multiple people because you want to implement stuff that will theoretically help you, but at the end of the day, it really doesn't.
Right. And I think your argument in the blog post, if you want to defeat pirates, keep releasing new versions of your software, because nothing discourages someone from pirating your software more than seeing that they have an old version of it and that they can't get the new version.
That kind of came about because I had some software that I was publishing back in probably 2002, 2003, and I was selling it, and I had put copy protection software on it, and it had gotten cracked, and then we released a new version, and then that got cracked, and then we released a new version, and then that one didn't get cracked. And I don't think that it was because somebody couldn't crack it, because it was the exact same encryption code. It was just a new version. I think that whoever was doing it, they just got bored, and they said, I'm not going to bother.
So I started the day off with a rant. You're going to start it off with some positive news. Did you get an email from someone?
Yes, I did. So last Thursday, I was having an absolutely horrendous day. There was tons of stuff that was just not going right. And I got an email from Bob Rupp, who said, just want to let you guys know that I really love the show. I found it searching through tech podcasts about 6 months ago and have been a loyal listener ever since. Thanks, guys, and keep up the good work. And that's all he said. You know, it just kind of made my day.
Very nice. I realize we haven't mentioned our Twitter handles in quite some time. So if you're a listener of the show and you're not following Mike and I on Twitter, check us out. Mike is Single Founder, and I am Rob Walling. How about an update on Audit Shark? What's the news?
Based on your previous comment about Twitter, I started working on the Audit Shark Twitter account and following a bunch of different people and just trying to get a small following there. And I got it up to around 40 or 50 people in 3 days or something like that, 4 days. I haven't put any extra time into it since then, but I'm starting to work on a process that I can hand to somebody and say, hey, I want you to start tweeting out links and stories and news articles to help grow that following a little bit. And then in terms of the website itself, I've roughly doubled traffic since November and December levels. So I've been doing some content marketing and SEO that is kind of starting to pay off at this point. I got to go back and take a look at some of the inbound links and some of the different keywords that I was looking at as potential targets to go after for SEO. But it's a matter of kind of prioritizing those and then putting up some new articles.
And what's the Audit Shark Twitter account?
Oh, it's just Audit Shark. At Audit Shark.
So if people are interested in hearing about security world, is that what you're going to be posting links about?
Yeah. So I haven't kind of fully fleshed out my strategy for it yet, but what I'm thinking about doing is kind of going to a bunch of different news sources and trying to figure out what links would be relevant to the people who would be following the account and what sort of security things are happening in the world. So for example, recently there's been a lot of problems in the Rails community because there's been some pretty significant, I don't want to say back doors, but security vulnerabilities that have kind of come out where you can take control of a server and basically run arbitrary code on that server, even if the application is designed in a secure way, because it has a problem to do with the framework itself, not necessarily the way that people are using it. And of course, that's a problem because if your Rails server gets compromised, it means that they can get access to anything that's on that server, including the database and all your customer data. And then they can use that to go into other servers. And just by doing a little bit of matching between different Rails applications, you could start whittling down to figure out, okay, well, who between these two different applications is using the same password on pretty much all their accounts? And then you could use that to launch massive attacks against some pretty major sites on the internet, you know, anything from Amazon or, you know, Microsoft, Oracle, etc. I mean, if these people are truly using the same email addresses and passwords on all those websites, it would be very easy to go into them and do different things, and especially when it comes into the things like banking. I mean, because people use, if you're reusing those usernames and passwords or the email addresses, it could be a huge problem. So I've been looking at that a little bit and trying to decide, I'll say, in how far into that rabbit hole I want to go. And I've actually reached out to a couple people in the Rails community to see if they would want to use Audit Shark to audit their servers to help monitor for changes of any critical system files. So for example, if the new users show up or new software gets installed, or if some of their code libraries are out of date, etc. And I've gotten some responses from that. So I'm looking into those right now.
Nice. So if folks are interested in that kind of stuff, I assume that's what you'll be talking about on your Twitter account.
Yep.
So on Sunday morning, I got an email from both you and my Hittail product manager saying your SSL cert's expired. And what had happened, this was totally me dropping the ball. When I acquired Hittail, it was maybe 18, 19 months ago, the previous owner had a 2-year SSL cert. And she had bought it on February, whatever, 2 years ago. And I don't know if you can transfer ownership. I should have just bought a new one, to be honest. But it was on the server and working, and I was able to export it and re-import it when I moved servers and just never thought about it. And so, bam, right in the middle of, it was probably early Sunday afternoon, Pacific time, the thing just stops working. So at least the website was up, the marketing site worked, but you just wouldn't, you know, when you click to register, that's SSL because it asks for credit card number, and I wasn't getting any trials. So the kicker is I went in, I knew it was a GoDaddy SSL cert, and of course I go to GoDaddy to try to just renew the cert, and I realized, that's when I realized, I don't actually own this cert, so there's no way that I can just renew it. So I generated a new request on the server, and I go to GoDaddy to try to fulfill the request, and they say, you can't take out a cert, for a wildcard cert for this domain name, because one already exists in our system, and it hasn't been purged, doesn't get purged for weeks after that. So I had to then call GoDaddy, and I have to tip my hat to GoDaddy. I'm shocked at how good their customer service was over the phone on a Sunday afternoon. And the guy got on with their SSL department, and they purge the old one. I sent in the request and they turned it around in like 10 minutes. For a wildcard cert, I was really impressed. And total time taken was about an hour from the time I heard, you know, from you and my product manager. But it was a little stressful for sure. I didn't know, because I kept imagining back in the day, you'd wait 24 hours to get an SSL cert back. And I was really hoping it didn't fling into Monday.
It depends on what type of SSL cert that you're getting. So there's this thing called an EV cert, which is extended validation, which gives you it's not just the little lock icon in your browser bar, but it also gives you the name of the company itself. So if you like go to PayPal or Bank of America, they tend to have those extended validation certificates. And it's supposed to signify to the end user that, oh, we have done an extended background check on this company, and that will take you several days or even a couple of weeks to get through. But with yours, I mean, it's not an extended validation, so you don't have to worry about it. And they can generally turn those around pretty quick. I get most of mine through either the SSL store or Komodo or GeoTrust, and their turnaround time on most of them is, you know, minutes. It does not take very long at all.
Yeah, so that was good news. It was just a little minor hiccup for Sunday afternoon. Luckily, it got resolved quickly. Derek is my product manager for Hittail. I should just start calling him by his first name. He emailed and then texted me, and that's what I needed was the text because I hadn't checked email that day.
Cool. I just finished up writing a e-course as an introduction to how to use Alteryx for my Alteryx training site, and I'm working on building a landing page for it, but I'm also touching base with some of the Alteryx sales engineers to see if they'd be willing to tell people about it, because they're in the field all the time and they're talking to customers. So these customers are obviously going to ask them questions about where can we get resources, and they will tell them, but at the same time, if they knew about my site, then they would probably tell them about my site and get more publicity for the site, just because these sales engineers tend to have a lot of clout when they're talking directly to the customers, and they take their thoughts and opinions on whether or not a site is a good resource. They treat it as if it has a lot of authority. So I think that if just by touching base with some of my old contacts through that network, I can definitely get some more people to the website, because the traffic is pretty much definitely leveled off back to where I had originally thought it would be. I don't see it going significantly back up without some extreme measures, just because the site doesn't get very much traffic for the keywords that I'm targeting, and there's not much else I can target for those keywords.
Right. Small organic SEO market, which makes sense. What's the e-course for? Is it to get SEO traffic? Is it going to rank for keywords, or is it to give away in exchange for an email?
Yeah, it's to give away in exchange for an email address, and then because I'm getting a lot of people to the site, or I'm getting, you know, enough people to the site, but my conversion rate isn't as high as I would like it to be. So what I'm trying to do is I'm just trying to get email addresses from those people, send them some valuable, relevant content that they're going to read hopefully on a daily basis, and then try to draw them back to the site in an effort to get them to buy it or to maybe sign up for other e-courses or something along those lines.
Got it. Yeah, in terms of getting email addresses, my landing page at getdrip.com, I started sending some paid traffic to that purely as a test of a couple things. I'm split testing some different headlines and body text of the landing page, and that's worked out well. There's already one variation of the test that has just completely flopped, and so that tells me that that particular, you know, that verbiage that I was using is suboptimal for this market. And what I like about the paid acquisition is it's not that I'm trying to actually make money at it. It's that it's just so easy to send a bunch of traffic to it really quick and kind of see how it behaves. At this point, I'm getting around 20% of the traffic that I'm sending from these two niches to provide their email address. So I'm fairly happy with that. It's not like outstanding, but it's definitely, you know, these are cold emails, people who've never heard of me or heard of the app or anything. So the fact that they're willing to type an email into a landing page is a good sign at this point.
Yeah, that's cool.
I want to go back and update folks on my Trello versus paper competition, right? I've always used paper for to-do lists, and I moved to Trello a couple months ago. And although I'm still using, I have a Moleskine notebook, the black notebook that I use for all my long-term items and my big thinking and, you know, anything that's like goals and such. But I got to be honest, man, I have not gone back to paper for the to-do list since I went to Trello. And I have the iPhone app, and I have it on the iPad, and I have it on my desktop, and I love that it's all synced, and then I can just pull it up anywhere and add stuff, move it around. It really is. Someone finally cracked that nut. You know, Fog Creek finally cracked it. And I have not found a reason not to use Trello still. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, that is. Well, you know, it's funny because it's funny that you bring up Trello, because I was trying to think of how to move some of the UI for Audit Shark into the cloud, just because I was talking to the developer that I have working on Audit Shark, and we were trying to hash out where would be the best place to host all that stuff, because right now everything is kind of split between the cloud, and then you have to have this policy builder, and it gets kind of complicated for the user. And it's like, well, the easiest thing to do would just be have everything in the cloud. So we were discussing how to kind of rework the UI and make it easier to use. And one of the things that I thought of was the way that Trello allows you to kind of drag and drop things between the different columns. And I was thinking that that would actually might make a very good UI for putting the policy builder into the cloud, because I was trying to figure out how to do that, you know, using like grids and tables and adding things back and forth between different columns and within the policies and control points. And it gets a little bit complicated and hard to explain unless you're kind of familiar with some of the different terms and how the policy builder works. But basically the idea of being able to drag and drop objects on the screen, that right there would solve like 95% of those issues.
Very nice. And I wonder if Fog Creek used a framework or something you could piggyback on so you don't have to build it from scratch. You know, I imagine they use jQuery or something that makes that easier.
Actually, they posted a couple of links on their blog that tell you specifically what the Trello stack is. So it started out, let's see here, they say that they've got CoffeeScript, Backbone.js, HTML5. They have this thing called Mustache, which is a templating language. And then they also have Socket.io and WebSockets, Ajax polling. They've got MongoDB, Redis, and a couple of other different things in here. And I probably wouldn't necessarily need all of these things, but the fact is that they tell you basically what they used for that. So if I wanted to build something that was similar, that was specifically designed for Audit Shark, then I could probably do it. And it would be significantly better than pretty much any other security product that is out there on the market right now. So, it's definitely something for me to think about. I just don't know how much effort it would take to build something like that.
Yeah, and if you haven't built something like that before, the learning curve will certainly be steep on the initial implementation. It's nice that that's what I like about software companies, is a lot of them will just say, here's how we did this. You know, that Fog Creek published that so that other people can go build cool stuff is really neat, and that's not done in a lot of industries. You don't see manufacturers showing you their process as a rule. I mean, it's pretty cool.
You know, with software, I mean, anybody can make it. It doesn't matter whether you tell everyone about your idea or tell nobody. I mean, the fact is, as soon as you launch it, everybody's going to take a look at it and say, oh, well, I could build that. And, you know, this is probably how you did it. And you can kind of reverse engineer most things. It's just you kind of have to put in the effort and do the work in order to rebuild something like that. It's not exactly a big secret.
Well, I have a couple last updates, and then maybe we'll dive into a few listener questions. Regarding Hittail, January was the best month ever. It actually had, not only that, but I had more trials than any month in the past. And previously, June of last year had the most trials, because it was the month that the AppSumo deal ran, and it sent a bunch of traffic. So it's a good kickoff to 2013. And what's nice is, since it's a 21-day trial, February should actually look good too. We got an unexpected write-up in Search Engine Watch. The head editor had seen a Hittail ad and had been familiar with Hittail from years ago. And so he wrote us up and then invited me on their Search Engine Watch podcast. And obviously that traffic would convert really well. And I guess the thing I realized, man, is it's like, the more you're out there, the more you have ads running, the more you're just being written about, the more we're getting contacted by joint venture partners, people who say, hey, we want to email our list, you email your list, you know, Search Engine Watch finding us. I mean, you just increase that, you know, that luck surface area, like Justin and Jason talk about. I mean, it just, being out there creates more exposure and more area for you to expand your business. So it's definitely working out, or at least it did work out in the month of January for us. So trying to maintain that growth and hit the growth goal of 2013, and on track for that so far. Last two updates. One is, I watched a movie on Netflix streaming. It's called Indie Game the Movie. I highly recommend it. It's about some software developers who are building indie games. And it's indie game is like, it's just one or two developers, so they're not associated with a studio. It is really cool. It captures the emotion, the struggles, the anxiety, how long it takes, how the internet can be really cruel if you put out a game and people don't like it. I mean, it very closely parallels what we do as developers, although their world is a little more subjective, right? Where people can just say your game is cool or not. At least with software, if we try to sell on value, we have a bit of a, you know, of a different measuring stick. But if you're at all into the software development stuff, I really recommend Indie Game. It's nice because it's free on Netflix if you have a subscription.
the other problem with selling games is either people like it or they don't. And if people don't like it, there's not a lot you can do to save it. It's not like a business application where it doesn't meet somebody's needs and you can tweak it until it does. But with a game, it's really hard to tweak a game so that people like it if it was just a complete dud or bust from day one.
Right. It's much more hit-based. It's like writing popular music or making a movie rather than building software for businesses.
Yep.
All right. Last thing is, our editor had a comment about last episode. Someone wrote in and they were talking about the organic delivery idea in New York. And she said that there is a grocery delivery service in New York City that delivers organic as well as other fresh food, and it's called Fresh Direct. She said it's a huge operation, and it's hard to imagine one person being able to coordinate that. She says Fresh Direct has been around for a number of years, and she's sure they started out small, but now they have a giant warehouse, thousands of trucks and drivers, and to deliver thousands of items within 24 hours of ordering them. There's no subscription fee. There is a delivery fee and a minimum amount you can spend. You know, we touched on that a little bit. Just because there's competition doesn't mean that you shouldn't do something if you can figure out a better way to do it. But if you are going to go head-to-head with a big incumbent player, you do need to figure out how are you going to be better or different than they are. And obviously, the logistical aspects of handling all this perishable food is quite a big thing to bite off. If you're willing to do that, and that's the kind of thing that interests you, by all means.
The problem with fruits and vegetables and things like that is what you run into a lot of what's called shrink in the retail industry. And shrink generally refers to any goods that are lost. But when you're talking about produce, what you're generally talking about there is stuff that just could not be sold because it wasn't any good. So whether the apples have bruises on them or something just went bad, you know, the milk expired, things like that. There's a lot more shrink in the produce industry than there is in the general retail. But general retail does have shrink as well. I mean, if clothes or something like that get ripped, or if a TV set, nobody wants the TV set where the box is kind of destroyed a little bit or mashed in on the side. I mean, that's why in the past, grocery stores used to take canned goods, and if the cans had dents in them, they would sell them to you at a discount. And now they don't do that anymore because people would take the cans and they just drop a whole case of them and say, oh, well, I get 50 cents off of each of these. So, but shrink is definitely a big concern in an industry like that.
Let's answer a few listener questions.
So the first one comes from Glenn Lawson, and he says, hi, Rob and Mike. Once again, thanks for continuing to produce the podcast, easily my favorite for several years now. Rob, I have a question for you. You've mentioned that you brought on a friend to be product manager for Hittail with the hope that he'll one day take up more responsibility with allowing you to focus on new products. Once you've launched or acquired a product and built it up to a stage where others can manage it with little direction from yourself, how do you maintain growth and encourage your staff to be passionate about the business and have the desire to grow it? Would love to hear your thoughts. Regards, Glenn.
There's a couple ways to do this for sure. The first thing is you need to hire the right people, right? You need to hire someone who is generally going to be passionate and excited about whatever they work on. Because if they don't have that, if you just hire someone who's kind of ho-hum about any job they do, then you're not going to be able to instill that in them. Second thing to think about is you want to hire someone who's specifically excited about startups or about growing startups or about being a startup founder. It's not something that I think can really be taught, but if someone is naturally excited about this concept of being a software entrepreneur, then it's awesome for them to learn on the job. And that's what I found with Derek, is just that he has such a thirst for knowledge and has such a desire to learn all the aspects of the business that, I mean, I remember, you know, being this back in the day, right? It's like you're a kid in a candy store because you're doing what you really enjoy every day and you're getting paid for it and you're just learning all this awesome stuff. And so those are the first two things I think will carry you a long way. And then at some point, I think if you're looking out long term, you do have to think about putting your motivations alongside the person that you hire. In other words, if you make out really well and the business does well, then you guys should both do well. And so that product manager should ultimately either get a share of profits or equity. And that's, again, may not be the first year or two that they work, but if you're thinking long-term, that has to be something in the back of your mind, because someone's not going to work forever just to put a bunch of money in your pocket. And they are always going to work harder if there's some more motivation to do that, to either, again, make more money in terms of equity or profit sharing.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of what you said rings true for most people, but the other side of the coin is, and I used to think this exact same way as well, you know, what is in it for the people that you're hiring? And the fact is that not everyone wants to run their own business. I mean, some people just want to be able to go to a job and do that job. And it doesn't mean that they're not passionate about it. It just means that they don't want to have to think about it when they're not working. So those are the type of people who are perfectly content to work for you. They're not going to actively be looking for the next ride to catch, the next business to jump onto. I mean, they want a job, they want a steady income, and they want to be able to enjoy their career. And as long as you're providing them with an environment where they are actually enjoying what they do, then you don't necessarily have to worry about that too much. And again, it depends on what type of person you hire and what they're interested in. But you can definitely run into those people who are more entrepreneurial in nature and want to go on and do their own thing. But there's definitely that contingent of people who don't want that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think I have a hard time giving advice in this area because my N is one, right? I've only done this once and I've found a certain type of person who works in a certain situation. And at this point, I don't know if I could replicate it yet. With a lot of the stuff that I give people advice about, I have done it many, many times in a repeated fashion. All the marketing, the starting a company, the growing, you know, the product revenue and all of that stuff. It's something that I feel confident that I've done it enough times that I do have an N of 10 or an N of 20, or my sample size is just larger. And so with this one, I have thoughts on it about how I would proceed. But to be honest, with, you know, really only the experience of one person, I have less of a leg to stand on in terms of giving others advice, in my opinion.
The next one's from Brian, and he says, I'm currently struggling with the decision whether or when to hire employee number one. My dilemma is I don't quite have the revenue yet to support this, but I'm also very bogged down in tasks that I'd like to hand off. So it's a chicken or the egg thing. An employee would help free me up to focus on growing revenue, but without the revenue, I can't afford an employee. Should I grind it out as I have been doing, mostly solo with steady but slow growth, and hire someone later when I can afford it? Or should I hire someone sooner and think of it as an investment to spur faster growth? Thanks, Brian. I think that the thing that you have to do here is take a look at the tasks that you have that you are spending a lot of time on and try to figure out which ones you're spending the most time on and which of those tasks could be outsourced to somebody at a part-time rate. I don't know as I would go down the path of hiring somebody full-time yet, but you can definitely find people who are looking for part-time work. And especially if you're doing things like support tasks where those types of things can be scripted and you can give somebody some general guidelines and say, this is my general blanket policy. If somebody asks for a refund, give it to them. If somebody wants you to help them out, go ahead and help them out. And you're paying them on an hourly basis. You can kind of have them touch base with you if they have any questions about that stuff. But what you're really looking to do is free up some of your time without having to pay for them to do it full time for you. And that allows you to kind of slowly get into it. And the one thing I would caution against for most people in general is if you've never been a manager before, it's very hard to jump in and just take on somebody as a full-time responsibility and have to manage their workload at all times. If you're having problems trying to make ends meet and pay their salary, the best suggestion that I would have is don't do that. You know, what you need to do is take them on a part-time basis and gradually move into that role. And if it doesn't work out, then that's fine. I mean, you've only taken them on as a part-time employee as opposed to a full-time employee. Because once you start taking someone on as a full-time employee, that's a huge responsibility, because especially if they've left another job to work for you. And if it doesn't work out, and a lot of these situations do not work out the first time because people are notoriously terrible at hiring people. So you're better off hiring somebody on a part-time basis, kind of testing the water, see how things go, and then move on from there if things work out. But if they don't, then, you know, cut the cord, move on to the next person. And at that point, you're not really torpedoing somebody's career or taking them away from a job that they realistically could have stuck around in for a while.
That's exactly what I was going to say. That's why we talk so much, and we have done this over and over. We did it with support in the academy, with support with Hittail. I could go on and on, literally 5-10 times I've done this. Hiring someone who starts off maybe only at 2 hours a week and they're purely on an as-needed basis. And that's where a nice project management tool like Odesk that actually tracks their time. There's things that can really track someone's time accurately. And then, like you said, you're only on the hook for the time they work. They can linearly scale up as the time expands. And in fact, at this point, I now have multiple people working over 20 hours a week, and I have one person working 40 hours a week, but none of them started at that point. They all started working a couple hours a week, and it allowed me to have the free cash flow to then go invest it in other things, in marketing approaches or in development costs. There's no reason to tie up a bunch of money in a full-time employee. I really don't see any reason to do that. Our next email is actually not a question. It was. It has the subject "Cool Stuff Found." It's from Carl, and he says, "A film is in the making that I thought might interest you and your listeners." And so if you visit startupkids.com, you can see a trailer for a movie. And it's a documentary about young web entrepreneurs in the U.S. and Europe. I did give him my email address because I'd love to hear when it comes out. But it has interviews with the founders of Vimeo, SoundCloud, Kip, Indonero, Dropbox, FoodSpotting, and several others. So it said it should be out in March of 2013. I'm into this type of thing, right? Though I love movies that observe, you know, all the stuff that we go through, and to see other people talk through it is just fascinating. So thestartupkids.com.
And I think our last question for the day comes from Ricardo, and he says, "Hi, Rob and Mike. Thanks for the show. We're a small SaaS company from Brazil with nearly 250 customers. Obviously, we love to get new customers and hate it, and I mean really hate it, to lose them. I hate it to the point that I'm disappointed with the whole business and mad with anyone who crosses my path for a few hours after each cancellation. I know we should be doing more marketing to get more customers more quickly, and what I want to hear from you is, what is your strategy for when you lose subscribers? From the moment someone requests a cancellation of the subscription to the moment you actually let them go, how do you deal with it? What sort of metrics do you take? At what point does it start to concern you? And more personally, how does it affect your mood and the way you treat your products? Thanks very much, Ricardo."
First thing to think about is to look at your product and figure out, are you past the point of product market fit? Meaning, have you built something that people want to use, that solves a problem that they have, and that you are marketing to the right market that really needs it? So if you are at 250 customers and they're happy and they love what you're doing, and you are able to find new customers and bring them into your app, then the answer to that would be yes. You know, if your churn rate's relatively low, you know, typically when your growth starts going up, your churn goes down, then you know that, you've quote unquote hit product market fit. Okay. If you're before that, then every cancellation is an opportunity to talk to that customer, find out why they canceled, find out if they just are never going to use your app, or if you're missing a single feature, if you're marketing to the wrong people. You know, there's a bunch of stuff that you can find out from them, and that's a whole other conversation, but that's the kind of pre-product market fit discussion. Once you're scaling and you're marketing and bringing new people in, churn is a fact of life, period. You're going to have people that cancel every month. And with 250 customers, I hope that number is not a lot of people. But in fact, in the early days of a SaaS app, while you're trying to hone your funnel and hone retention and get all your features in to keep people happy, you can easily have churn of 10 or 20% a month. Now, you can't have that for very long. You're obviously losing a lot of customers. 20% churn with 250 customers is 50 customers a month, and you'll essentially be at zero in 5 months. So realize that, but no matter how well you hone that and how good you get that number, how low you get it, you are always going to have a few people that cancel. So I think there's kind of the mental aspect of it. You said you get, you know, angry when people cancel. I would take yourself out of that loop so that you are no longer receiving that email and having to cancel them. If it really does impact you and impacts your productivity and the way that you're working with other people, I would say give that to an assistant or a tier one support or something and let them handle that. Because you don't need to know about every single cancellation. If there are comments given in the cancellation box, which you should always ask, why are you canceling, and require, you know, at least X characters. If there are comments given in that, then yes, maybe you should see all of those every week and be able to read through them. But in terms of you getting angry every time they cancel, that you should probably remove yourself from that process. Second thing I think is you have to look at them in aggregate, and that actually takes away a little bit of the emotion from it. And what I mean by in aggregate is look at the percentage. So tracking churn percentage, which is the number of customers who canceled in a month divided by the number of customers you have at the beginning of that month, is, you know, an absolute key SaaS metric. So you need churn, you want to calculate lifetime value, and of course, the monthly average revenue per customer. But in terms of churn, you also want to break it up into multiple durations, because with SaaS and with any kind of subscription, you're going to have higher churn in the first period that they're a customer. So for some businesses, it's the first 30 days has really high churn, and that can be 20 or 30%. And then after that, it'll settle way down. And by way down, I mean, it can be 2% or 5%, like really low areas. In other businesses, your first 60 days have high churn, and in others, the first 90 days. So you just have to calculate yours, and you see, you watch and look when that churn drops off. And then I would look at your first X days. So for you, it'll be 30, 60, 90 probably. So I'd say, you know, look at your first 60 days churn and then look at your post 60 day churn. And those are really the numbers you want to track on an ongoing basis. And you want to either have a graph of those that you can look at so you can easily see the change in churn, or you want to have a table, you know, worst case, you have a table of your current month plus all your previous months so that you can eyeball it and see, is my churn going up or down? When your churn is too high, then you have to implement a bunch of stuff to try to bring it down. And again, that's probably an entire podcast or maybe a microconf talk that needs to happen to talk about specific ways to bring churn down. There are a lot of different ways to do it. Those are my initial thoughts on it. Mike, do you have anything to add?
I like a lot of the things that you said regarding what metrics to take and, you know, when it should start to concern you. Those are good things. I think the number one point that you said was to kind of remove yourself from that feedback loop if it's really affecting the way that you work and the things that you're getting done. That, I would say, is probably the single most important thing to do. The one other thing that I would point out is that this is definitely a situation where it seems like you're taking these cancellations personally. And the one thing that I would point out is that while you're getting these emails and somebody is actively telling you, hey, I'm really not interested in your product anymore, it's not a lot different than somebody coming to your website and looking at your products and saying, I'm not interested. And 98% of those people who come to your website are not interested and they leave. But for some reason, those people are not irritating you. It's these people who have actually gone through that extra step, have looked at your product, have probably made a couple of payments. And at that point, that's where, you know, you're getting these feelings of anger from these people who are saying, well, you know what, I've tried it out. I really don't like it. It's not for me. It's not going to fit for what my needs are. My point is that there's not a lot of difference between those two. And there's this much larger group of people who are telling you no. And the only reason you're taking it personally is because you don't get that feedback loop. So again, just kind of going back to what Rob said, definitely take yourself out of that. Have somebody else email them back, ask them why they're canceling, get the information that you need, and then just give it to you in aggregate.
That wraps us up for today. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.